I'm going to be 70 years old. There hasn't been a day in my life that Great Britain hasn't been under Queen Elizabeth II. So yesterday was a day in history which is a sad day for Great Britain and a day that impacts the world. And we'll bring in David Taratruk to talk a little bit about this. David, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Well, hello. Yes, I'm back in the media capital of the world, New York City, my inescapable home base for reporting on the media, and I'm glad, as always, to be joining the ever-alert Marshall Miles. But inevitably, yes, Marshall, we're instantly looking abroad, and perhaps we should ourselves voice what they've been saying in my old home country for centuries, with occasional variants over time regarding gender, of course. That phrase now is, the Queen is dead, long live the King. So yes, at the age of 96, Queen Elizabeth II lived 14 years longer than the previous longest reigning monarch, Queen Victoria, and indeed reigned 7 more years than Victoria did. Among many people in Britain of my generation, it's a commonplace often heard that their first memory of television was Elizabeth's coronation in 1953, when the event prompted a massive upsurge in sales of television sets. It wasn't the case for me. I'm a media guy who didn't grow up seeing any television. My family was in a socioeconomic class well below the television-owning classes. But I do remember at the age of 5, all the cheery red, white, and blue flags in our village streets, like millions of Brits, rather like you yourself, Marshall. As you said, she is the only monarch I've ever known, from a distance, of course. The only way to know her, if you're someone like me. And professionally, unlike some of my colleagues, I've never done any stints of royal reporting. It's a thankless job, it's always seemed to me. The royal family has always had a curious relationship with the press. They seem to need each other, and there's been a queasy, symbiotic relationship throughout the last century and into this one, getting even queasier, I guess, in recent times. Elizabeth herself is credited with humanizing, and even, Lord help me, democratizing the Institute, in some people's view. In that a landmark change happened, it was in 1972, when she allowed cameras, BBC's cameras, of course, into the palace and other royal residences and royal events to make a documentary simply called The Royal Family. It was unheard of. Richard Causton, the dean of BBC Program Makers, was the director, and his coverage of candid moments with royal personages was indeed historic. It was remarkable in its day for the chance to see the Queen outside of her scripted performances once a year in her address to the nation and the so-called British Commonwealth, which was always recorded and broadcast traditionally on Christmas Day. That year when the documentary was shown, I was covering war in Northern Ireland and wars in Africa, so I couldn't really see it as a great breakthrough for journalism, but certainly it was very different for the royal family to be seen in that way. Since I've moved here, I noticed that, well, nobody looking worldwide can miss the fact that American media have been somewhat hysterical about the British royals, you know, in a way that really did surprise me. I mean, they're much more hysterical in many ways than the British press, for whom the royals can be viewed as just part of the national furniture, as it were. But one thing about American coverage is sort of appropriate, I've noticed. British royals are the staple diet, perfectly naturally, it seems, of showbiz journalism. They fit right in as subjects on TV programs like Access Hollywood and Entertainment Tonight. Something like that wouldn't happen in Britain, where the royals are covered by serious, supposedly serious news programs. But I just want to point out something that it struck me as off-key in American coverage of the Queen's death. It's been acutely disappointing to me. In fact, the Atlantic magazine, which was frequently earned fanfares here on the media beat, not least in the last couple of years for its exemplary COVID coverage, simply great science journalism. But it's really made me want to withdraw endorsements of the Atlantic because of its breathless fawning about Elizabeth II. The headline on their tribute was Queen of the World. I'm afraid that's a ridiculous notion, insulting readers' intelligence. I don't want to be accused of lesser majesty or still less, being in some way disrespectful to the Queen, but I think some of the media coverage, and even including the admirable Atlantic, has been way overboard. I should say, though, that because of the media age she lived through, she did come to have a global audience. So she was probably the most recognized woman in the world. And she certainly did take seriously her role, not just as the constitutional symbol of government for the UK, and I stress symbol of government. She didn't govern. She reigned, she didn't rule. It was the favorite phrase of Buckingham Palace. But she was also a symbolic figurehead for that loose grouping of countries, former colonies, not including the United States, of course, as a former colony, called the Commonwealth, or initially the British Commonwealth, more lately the Commonwealth of Nations. One African leader told me, and I suppose since the Queen is now dead, and so is he for a long time now, I can name him as Kenneth Kaunda, the longtime president of Zambia, told me he just loved dancing with Elizabeth at their international conferences, something which I think everybody knew. It was pretty obvious how much he enjoyed it when they danced together. But he also whispered to me that, let me quote him directly, "I've come to have quite a crush on your queen, David." I really didn't quite know what to say in response to that.
Well, you know, what I've been talking about is whether you understand the monarchy, know the monarchy, dislike the monarchy, whatever, and as Americans and as citizens of the world, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around the fact that if you're 69 or 70 years old, there really hasn't been a day you've been actively aware of anything that she hasn't been the Queen of England. For people, the first time you're going to hear it. I can imagine how impactful this is in Great Britain. They're going to actually hear so many people for the first time, millions of people, the King of England.
Absolutely. And that sense of elevation is extraordinarily redolent. It's a complex mix of attitudes involved, I think. Loyalty, admiration. Once upon a time, we would have called it obedience, but in the modern day, that's not what is owed to someone in the Queen's position. My memory of KK, as Kenneth Kaunda liked some of us to call him, is significant here. He called her my queen, is what he said. I didn't feel any sense of possession over the queen, but he called her the queen, like everybody else did. Sometimes your majesty, if you're speaking to her directly. KK was quite different from his fellow African president, South Africa's Nelson Mandela, who reveled in calling her Elizabeth, much to the horror of her courtiers. We should remember that the once white-ruled South Africa was originally part of the British Empire. Well, not originally, it was Dutch at one point, but the Brits took it over. In that much replayed clip, everyone's playing it right now, from Elizabeth's pledge when she was turning 21, I mean, a long time ago now, to a lifetime of what she called service to our people. It was an oath. It was a pledge. She made that in South Africa. That's not pointed out often when that clip's played. And she was actually talking about the people of the empire. She made that very clear in the speech, and that part of it isn't played so much. Well, after 1961, because of the white supremacist rule in South Africa, remember the ugly rule of apartheid, South Africa was about to be expelled from the Commonwealth. And it then preemptively left the association itself. Now, 30-something years later, Mandela was released from the life imprisonment that was imposed on him by the racists. But he wasn't yet president, of course, at this point. We're talking about 1991. But he showed up at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. It's got the ugly acronym CHOGGAMS, Commonwealth Heads of Government Conference, that was being held nearby in Africa, in neighboring Zimbabwe. Now, legend has it that Queen Elizabeth quickly ordered a new setting to be laid at a dinner table for him. More realistically, it was a well-orchestrated PR stunt, if you like, by the Commonwealth Secretariat, headed by its Secretary General, Shudaf Ramphal from Guyana, a great cricket player, by the way. He even persuaded me to play on the Commonwealth side once. Now, the Queen danced with Mandela there. He wasn't yet even a Commonwealth head of government, though he was to be so within a few short years. And later, when President Mandela took to calling her Elizabeth, when he was president, he was stressing to his people that he, a black president, and the Queen of England were equals. And she was very adept and very used to an awful lot of very senior politicians. We know that. She knew every UK prime minister since Churchill, called every one of them to office when they'd been elected by the people. And, of course, she would see them on a weekly basis. And she also knew every United States president since Truman, except, as it happened, and I'm not sure the reason for this, she never met Lyndon Johnson. Now, that's a meeting I would have liked to see, if only it could have happened. can you imagine that, Marshall?
Well, I could imagine the connection with Balmoral and also Lyndon Johnson's ranch and dogs. And just starting off right there on the personal side, never mind then getting into the international and the both countries side. Yeah, I think that would have been a hell of a meeting.
It could have been. Well, she said there's very striking footage, of course, of her riding with President Reagan. A real horsewoman, and President Reagan, perhaps not a real horseman, but well known as a cowboy in many different senses, certainly in the movies. The conventional media narrative, I should point out, is that she's always been with her own political leaders, her prime ministers, that she was the steady presence. And that she maintained a helpful, calming influence through her wise counsel to the politicians, who, being politicians, of course, could be very variable. But it has to be said, and again, I mean no disrespect here, but just keeping carefully to the record, the actual record of events throughout her extraordinary 70-year reign, it was at least one of those prime ministers, and I'm referring specifically to Tony Blair, even when he was still he was still very new to the job, but he was the one who had to be the person giving wise counsel to her when she, uncharacteristically, as we look back on it now, I suppose, but at the time, it was very much in her nature. She totally misread the mood of the British public after Princess Diana's death, with remarkable tone deafness, really. she remained in regal isolation and silence in Scotland when the nation was consumed in its extraordinary grief over the death of Diana. She found it hard to understand, perhaps not surprisingly. And Tony Blair, had to explain it to her. And eventually she did speak to her people. Tony got his way. A little stiffly, perhaps, but live on television, trying to capture the moment and express sympathy with the nation's feeling of loss. Now, the younger generations of her family have given Elizabeth a lot of trouble, of course. We know that, too. But the spotlight now falls on the most senior of them, finally getting the job he's been preparing for through 70-plus years, King Charles III. As you said, it's a strange notion that we'll be talking about the King of England now. And it's not a very propitious name for an English king, if you know your English history. And a little weird to hear that numeral with that name, Charles III. But I guess we'll get used to it. Though, of course, he can't be with us as monarch for anything like as long as his mother was. I don't know him personally, though I do know well several people who do know him well. And I'm going to make a journalist prediction here, and you know how wary I am about those such things. Journalist predictions. I suspect we may see some bursts of long pent-up energy now that Charles has acceded to the throne. He's speaking to the nation later today. Perhaps we'll hear some signals of what that new energetic rule might be. Energetic for a 70-plus-year-old king, I hasten to underline.
And now, basically, for the foreseeable future, even after him, it will be the King of England.
The line of succession is clear. I mean, unless a remarkable set of unfortunate events could possibly happen that interrupt that line of succession. But yeah, it's boys from now on again.
Well, I want to switch away from one leader, and I mentioned this earlier also. When you speak in terms of length of leadership or holding a position, her 70 years was amazing, even more than despots and dictators who never, ever reach that type of length. North Korea now, this week, with their leader, declared itself a nuclear weapon state and stated that it was irreversible and that they would never give up the possibility there won't be any denuclearization.
Yeah. No news there, although it was presented as a news event. I mean, the statement is a fresh, a renewed, if you like, clarification of the fact that although there are bound to be, because of the division along the 49th parallel and the DMZ between North and South Koreas, there will occasionally be conversations, and the subject will arise again that in order to get any kind of normalization of relations between North and South Korea, there's going to have to be change, and North Korea, the demand will come from the South, and their giant backers, the United States, of course, will be saying once again that we'll have to rein in the nuclear ambitions of North Korea. Well, it couldn't be clearer that's not going to happen as far as the North Koreans are concerned. And we may as well recognize that that's going to be the truth for the foreseeable future. But, you know, politics is all about the art of pressure and the various pressures that can be brought to bear on North Korea will come up again and again, and perhaps they will, in a cumulative sense over time, they will get to the point where we, the West, that is, can insist that North Korea think again about their commitment to being a nuclear power. But as they say in other circles than the diplomatic tables of negotiation, good luck with that. I think it's very unlikely.
The only possibility that if you can't feed your own people, sooner or later your own people will rise up. I don't know if that's possible in North Korea, but anyway, finally we'll move on to Ukraine. They now claim to have recaptured more than 1,000 kilometers, or about 400 square miles of territory, and actually taking back 20 towns in their offensive. Pretty hefty claim, and some of the people that watch this that are from military experts from the United States and Europe say that the troops, it appears troops have advanced almost 31 miles since this push in the south began.
Yes, Ukraine is on the offensive, is the message, and much of the press is kind of excited about that. And you know, we as usual on the media beat, we try and adopt a cool approach to things that other people sometimes get excited about. There are advances. And it is remarkable, and Ukraine is achieving this because of all the help with hardware and in some cases intelligence assistance too that they're getting from Western powers. I know the United Kingdom's intelligence services are closely engaged in this fight and providing support to the Ukrainian government and its forces. But yes, there's a towns, there's small towns in the main that are being seized. No major city has been captured yet. But it is an indication, I think, of the kind of lightly moving, not fast moving by any means, offensive status of the Ukraine's forces now. It's a standoff. It's slightly mobile, not entirely static, but nonetheless, I think it's developing into a kind of grinding warfare, which will go on until, as the United States, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Milley, was saying only today, that eventually, the negotiating table has got to be the next step. Again, it's a matter of how much the pressure builds up on both sides to make that move to a conference table. And the aim is, of course, to preserve on the west side is to maintain a free, independent Ukraine, devoid of any Russian occupation. But quite how the map of Ukraine is going to be drawn when we get to that table is unknown as yet. I mean, we can't possibly see what that will be, or indeed how the negotiations would go. But that seems to be the scenario ahead of us, a grinding war, unfortunately, that will continue probably for a good long time, or a bad long time. That's inevitably in the future for that conflict. I can't see any other way.
And one final look question for you, David. In this age, over the past 6-7 years, especially over the previous 4 years, the rage against newspapers, news media, by our own government. It hit home this week. A Las Vegas journalist was killed, allegedly, by one of the members of Las Vegas government that she was covering. A frightening story.
Yeah, well, it's commonplace in places like Mexico. Mexico, probably the most dangerous country in the world for a journalist to work, except for active war zones, of course. But yes, the inevitable phenomenon of people in power being so aggrieved at journalists' efforts to investigate them and reveal the truth about them means that the journalists get threatened and indeed sometimes killed. The fact that it should happen in the United States of America, where the famous First Amendment proclaims the freedom of an independent press, freedom from fear of being killed, you would think was a primary human right protected by that constitutional amendment. But yes, it's an appalling sign of the degeneration of the American political climate when that can happen. That we're seeing, and you're quite right. I mean, we're seeing an extraordinary upsurge in anger, mostly on the right. We have to say, mostly on the right, against the whole notion of a free press. The press's job, it is argued, if that's the right term for it, the splenetic outbursts that come from the right. That it's no place for the journalists to be investigative and to be interrogative and to ask the difficult questions. If that duty ends up in journalists being killed, then yes, we're going down a terrible road. But we've seen this coming for some time, and we shouldn't be surprised, even if we are shocked.
All right, as we wrap up this edition of the Media Beat, they're about to begin a 96-round gun salute in honor of the Queen. David, always a pleasure to talk with you.
We'll look forward to talking to you next week.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on The Breakfast Club on Robinhood Radio. You can find him at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on the Media Beat, and you can find him at his own website, which is themediabeat.us.